Ladies and gentlemen, I've just been handed a message that came in from Grover's Mill by telephone. Just one moment, please. At least 40 people, including 6 state troopers, lie dead in a field east of the village of Grover's Mill. Their bodies burned and distorted beyond all possible recognition.
Those chilling words written by Howard Koch and delivered as part of the Mercury Theater's Sunday, October 30th, 1938 broadcast of The War of the Worlds on the CBS radio network helped send America into a panic which would forever redefine the power of broadcasting.
Affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
I'm your host, Joe Bevilacqua. You'll be hearing exclusive interviews with War of the Worlds associate producer, John Houseman. It's writer Howard Koch, along with actor Arthur Anderson, who worked with Orson Welles on the Mercury Theater, and the people of Grover's Mill, New Jersey, and their reaction to the broadcast. First, John Houseman explains how the show came about.
The series was Orson's series. Since I was his partner, I acted as associate producer with him, and editor, and for a while I wrote them. By the time we'd gotten to War of the Worlds, which was the renewal by CBS of the series, we just hired another writer, a new writer, who got all of $50 a week for writing one full hour radio show. That was Howard Koch.
We asked Howard Koch how he became involved in the project.
I was doing the weekly radio plays for the Mercury Theater of the Air, Orson Welles and John Houseman. And the third assignment they gave me was a story by H.G. Wells called War of the Worlds. And Orson wanted it done in a different way. He wanted it done in news bulletin and first person singular. And contemporary. Orson and I chose it. We decided the time had come we should be doing a science fiction show, and so we tried a few that weren't very easy to do, and so we fell back on that. And, you know, I was the one who assigned it to Howard, and when Howard got in trouble, I was the one who conferred with him, and that's when we decided to update it, mm-hmm. bring it to...
I told Houseman, who was working between the studio and my apartment on 72nd Street, that I didn't think I could do it. I had 6 days. I didn't think I could do it the way Orson wanted in 6 days. And I tried to switch him to another story.
So he had trouble in what sense? In the sense of
he
the just, language?
He said it was dull. No, he said it was boring. Mm-hmm. If it was something that happened 50 years ago, everybody knows it didn't happen. So who the hell cared?
Right. And word came back from Orson, no, I want this done. Go ahead, we'll help, go ahead. So I worked day and evening for those 6 days and got it done just before, with the last Houseman kept taking pages down from my apartment, 72nd Street, to the studio.
And by updating it, it immediately became an exciting show that made sense.
Mm-hmm. Big off! The top blue!
Look out there! Stand back!
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the most terrifying thing I've ever witnessed. Wait a minute. Someone's crawling
someone
out
or
something. I can see turning out of that black hole two luminous disks. The eyes, it might be a face, might be almost... Good heavens. Something wriggling out of the shadow like a gray snake. Now it's another one and another one and another one. They look like tentacles to me. Oh, yeah, I can see the thing's body. Now it's large. It's large as a bear. It glistens like wet leather, but that face... ladies and gentlemen, it's indescribable. I can hardly force myself to keep looking at it. It's so awful. The eyes are black and they gleam like a serpent. The mouth is this kind of V-shaped with saliva dripping from its rimless lips. It seems to quiver and pulsate. And the monster or whatever it is can hardly move. Seems weighed down by possibly gravity or something.
Howard did a very good job. Decided to update it, everybody sort of pitched in. Everybody had ideas to make it more vivid and more real, except Orson. Orson, curiously enough, hardly saw that script before the day of the broadcast.
As John Houseman explains, Sometime around 2 the afternoon of the broadcast, when the show began to take shape under Orson's hands, a strange fervor seemed to invade the studio, and the first to feel it were the actors.
It's starting to rain again. The rain had...
Mr. Hausman recalls actor Frank Riedick, who played the part of Carl Phillips, the network special reporter, had gone down to the record library and dug up a recording of the explosion of the Hindenburg at Lakehurst, New Jersey.
Oh, my, get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast, and all the folks agree that this is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's like 20, oh, 400 or 500 feet into the sky, and it's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen.
Riedick played the Hindenburg recording to himself over and over. Then, recreating the emotion in his own terms, he described the Martian meteorite.
Ladies and gentlemen, am I on? Ladies and gentlemen, here I am, back of a stone wall that adjoins Mr. Wilmer's garden. From here, I get a sweep of the whole scene. I'll give you every detail as long as I can talk and as long as I can see. More state police have arrived. They're drawing up a cordon in front of the pit. Wait a minute, something's happening. A humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Ah! The whole field caught up by the woods, the barns, the gas tanks of the automobiles spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
There followed a moment of absolute silence, an eternity of waiting. It was one of the many devices with which Orson Welles succeeded in compelling not merely the attention, but also the belief of his invisible audience.
Then, as usual, he did wonders. He is largely responsible for what I think is perhaps the most exciting thing about that script, about that show, is the timing of it. Mm-hmm. And Orson had a courage to do certain, to start that show so slowly that you almost couldn't believe anybody would stay with it.
On this particular evening, October 30th, the Crosley Service estimated that 32 million people were listening in on radios.
For the next 24 hours, not much change in temperature. A slight atmospheric disturbance of undetermined origin is reported over Nova Scotia, causing a low-pressure area to move down rather rapidly over the northeastern states, bringing a forecast of rain accompanied by winds of light gale force. Maximum temperature 66, minimum 48. This weather report comes to you from the Government Weather Bureau. We take you now to the Meridian Room in the Hotel Park Plaza in downtown New York, where you will be entertained by the music of Raymond Raquello and his orchestra.
And yet that's what finally made it credible, because if you start that slowly, the audience sort of settles in, and then when it starts to accelerate, they follow you.
If it was Orson Welles, the director, who was responsible for slowing down the pace of the broadcast to make it more believable, it was Orson Welles, the actor, who was able to sustain the dramatics for the rest of the program. Actor Arthur Anderson, who worked with Orson Welles on the Mercury Theater broadcasts, explains.
His young age had nothing to do with his voice. By that, I mean his voice was a very rich, round, full voice, and you would never guess that he was still in his teens.
I've been hiding in this empty house near Grover's Mill, a small island of daylight cut off by the black smoke from the rest of the world. All that happened before the arrival of these monstrous creatures in the world now seems part of another life. Life that has no continuity with the present. Furtive existence of the lonely derelict who pencils these words on the back of some astronomical notes bearing the signature of Richard Pearson. I look down at my blackened hand and I try to connect them with a professor who lives at Princeton and who on the night of October 20th glimpsed through his telescope an orange splash of light on a distant planet. My wife, my colleagues, my students, my books, my observatory, my world, where are they? Did they ever exist? Am I Richard Pearson? What day is it? Do days exist without calendars?
And I then worked with Orson in radio, the Mercury Theater on the Air, which later became sponsored by Campbell's Soup.
Howard Koch.
And, of course, Orson and Hausman and their crew were very talented people, and they did an awfully good job at the production of it. They knew how to cast it. They knew how to time it. They did everything right.
We spoke to John Hausman in his New York apartment about what it was like doing live radio.
It was absolute chaos.
So give us a little bit of a quick scenario.
Well, it was a chaos because we never really... they were put on in something of a hurry, and they were quite elaborate shows. And we never really knew what our timing was. I mean, now that was not too serious because Orson was a past master at slowing or speeding, and his vocal capacities were such that if we were 10 minutes short, he could lengthen it, and if we were 10 minutes long, he could speed it. And then we did a lot of editing at the last moment. That contributed to the hysteria. And Orson, by temperament, was also liked to work in the atmosphere of hysteria.
We asked Arthur Anderson what it was like working with Orson Welles on radio. He told us some anecdotes, such as one showing how Orson Welles loved playing practical jokes.
Philip Morris Playhouse, a half-hour dramatic show, one of those which in those days were done in Broadway theaters, which were hired by the broadcasting companies. The men were dressed in tuxedos. The ladies were in evening dress. The curtain went up. The lights went up. The orchestra played. And it was pure glamour because, after all, you were witnessing a coast-to-coast broadcast. Well, this particular broadcast, Orson had the opening speech. I don't know what the nature of the program was. He had the opening speech. And the announcer came before the audience and said, "No, we're about to go on the air, ladies and gentlemen. I want you to be very quiet. I want you to know you are witnessing a coast-to-coast broadcast." All the actors were ready, everyone clearing their throats, and Orson was ready. And the director was about to give the cue when Orson's script dropped to the floor. Now, it didn't just drop to the floor. It dropped all over the floor. The pages were scattered over the entire stage. Well, there was panic as everybody rushed to pick up the pages of Orson's script to try to get the pages in the proper order. Page one, have you got one? You've got two. Oh, here's page eight. Well, put it next to page seven. And all of this was sotto voce and frantic as the hands of the clock approached the time for the broadcast. And it would look like they weren't going to make it because they could not get these pages of the script together because it happened only seconds before airtime. But just as the cue came, the show went on the air, Orson pulled the real script from the inside breast pocket of his coat. And I can imagine what the director must have been saying in the control room. "Why, you?" And went on the air flawlessly. He loved practical jokes.
This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen. Out of character, to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be. The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo.
We had extremely skilled people working. The actors were the best actors in radio. And radio is a hysterical medium anyway. And it didn't bother them. It didn't faze them. We had... Benny Herman was a very temperamental man himself. So we had all kinds of terrible screaming matches with Benny over the music. But that was all right. That was sort of par for the course. He did that with everybody. And the sound men were expert sound men.
I think some of the best. They were really creative because a lot of these sounds were on 78 RPM records. And to be able to spot a sound, which means to put the needle down on the record at exactly the right spot where the lion roars or the waterfall starts or the wave breaks, this required as much art as being an actor, in my mind. Maybe more, I don't know.
He's having an argument with the policeman. Now, the policeman wins. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there's something I haven't mentioned in all this excitement, but it's becoming more distinct. Perhaps you've caught it already on your radio. Listen, please. Do you hear it? It's a curious humming sound that seems to come from inside the object. I'll move the microphone nearer. Here. Now, we're not more than 25 feet away. Can you hear it now? Professor Pearson.
Yes, Mr. Brooks.
Can you tell us the meaning of that scraping noise inside the thing?
Possibly the unequal cooling of its surface.
I say, do you still think it's a meteor, Professor?
Do you think that its success had something to do with the time period?
Of course. Well, it wouldn't. It probably would have happened anyway, but it happened much more easily because of the fact that it followed the Munich crisis by a couple of months. Two things happened there. One, people had suddenly, for the first time in history, become accustomed to getting their news out of the box instead of out of the papers. That was number one. Number two, the whole atmosphere of crisis and anxiety was still very much alive after Munich, and I think it made it much more easy to be fooled by this broadcast.
Another important factor as to why listeners believed that what they were hearing was true was that the Mercury Theater aired directly opposite the most popular radio show at the time, the Chase and Sanborn Hour, with Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy.
Well, tell me, was the car badly damaged?
Well, it's sort of... Well, Bergen, why split hairs? Junk is junk.
Well, I'd like to see this car for myself. Now, just where is it? Well,
when Edgar Bergen introduced a new and not very popular singer about 8:12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, a large number of listeners began twisting their dials in search of other entertainment. Many of them turned to CBS, and when they did, they stayed put. For by this time, the mysterious meteorite had fallen at Grover's Mill, New Jersey, and the Martians had begun to show their foul, leathery heads.
Four companies of state militia are proceeding from Trenton to Grover's Mill and will aid in the evacuation of homes within the range of military operations. Thank you.
You have just been listening to General Montgomery Smith, commanding the state militia at Trenton. In the meantime, further details of the catastrophe at Grover's Mill are coming in. The strange creatures, after unleashing their deadly assault, crawled back in their pit and made no attempt to prevent the efforts of the firemen to recover the bodies and extinguish the fire. The combined fire departments of Mercer County are fighting the flames which menace the entire countryside.
Within minutes, people all across the country were praying, crying, and fleeing frantically to escape death from the Martians. The reaction to the broadcast was strongest at points nearest the tragedy. In Newark, New Jersey, in a single block, more than 20 families rushed out of their houses with wet handkerchiefs and towels over their faces. Some began moving furniture. Police switchboards were flooded with calls inquiring, "Shall I close my windows and have the police any extra gas masks?" Police found one family waiting in the yard with wet clothes on their faces, contorted with hysteria.
Excuse me, what was the
uproar?
The atmosphere afterwards?
Well, it was very disagreeable because of... for at least a couple of hours or more, and really until the next morning, we believed we were mass murderers because the press, which was very hostile to radio, was delighted of this opportunity to piss on radio and to say that they were irresponsible and so on. They did all the usual newspaper tricks. I mean, they would say, well, you've heard about the family that was killed on the highway in New Jersey. How many other deaths have you heard about?
The 50th anniversary of the War of the Worlds broadcast is now being celebrated, the opening of which was appropriately at Grover's Mill, New Jersey, where the fictional Martians first landed.
My name is Steve Dechter. I'm the mayor of West Windsor Township, and I'm here on behalf and with the support of the West Windsor Township Committee, our governing body, and welcome to Grover's Mill, West Windsor Township, on October 30.
Many of the townspeople got up and spoke about how they reacted to the broadcast.
I was on duty at the New Brunswick Station, State Police, and about 8:15, the call started to come into the barracks. I was on desk duty. The calls were coming in from people in the area wanting to know where to go. I didn't know what they were talking about. After a while, they said, "We're being invaded. We're being invaded by Martians." The calls kept coming in, and I would say within the hour, I received over 100 calls at the barracks. The local police in New Brunswick had people coming into the barracks and saying, which way shall we go? They have their car packed, they have their families in the car. They wanted to know which way to head for to get out of town. Trying to quiet these people down, they wouldn't even listen to the police. They said, no, it's a true story. Come out to the car. We have it on the car radio.
That day, the operators at CBS had been given a lecture on how to be more polite to people who were inquiring, making inquiries over the telephone. And, during that evening, the supervisor was walking up and down, and she was listening to how the operators responded to the questions that were coming in. And she heard one say very nicely, I'm sorry, we don't have that information here. And the supervisor went up and complimented and said, that was very nicely spoken. What was the question? She wanted to know whether it was the end of the world.
I happened to walk into my house after being out somewhere and turned on the radio. And I did come break into this program in the middle of it when it sounded like a bona fide news commentator describing the terrible things happening to Grover's Mill. So I was quite startled for about 3 to 5 minutes, and I listened a little further, and they came on a station break or something, and I realized that it was just a story.
And I was at a youth Christian fellowship meeting, and there were about 10 or 15 of us in the room, and someone came barging in, opening the door, and said, the Martians have landed, the Martians have landed. And we all looked at each other and wondered, the Martians have landed. And the very first thing that came in my mind, I said, well, I'm in the Lord's house, and I'm sure the Lord will take care of us.
There was no expectation on my part that that was going to create all of this furor. I even wondered whether it was going to be a good show, because I couldn't tell. Things were going so fast.
And so we really seriously believed we were responsible for a considerable number of deaths.
Which, of course, turned out not to be true.
Turned out not to be true. There were a few miscarriages, a couple of broken legs, mm-hmm. people slipping while they were running away from the Martians, but that was it.
They tried to reach me during the night to let me know about the panic and what was going on. But I was dead to the world and didn't wake up. So the next morning, I always had that half day off before beginning a new assignment. And I walked down 72nd Street to get a haircut. And I heard people's parts of conversation, invasion, war, so on. And I rushed into the barber shop and said, has Hitler moved? Are we at war or something? And he laughed and he held up the paper with a big headline, Martian invasion, play, panic station, or words to that effect. And, well, that was a strange moment in my life. And, well, what happened after changed all our lives, Orson's, Hausman's, mine. Everybody connected with it.
We annihilated the world before your very ears and utterly destroyed the CBS. You will be relieved, I hope, to learn that we didn't mean it and that both institutions are still open for business.
Well, you know, we were in some danger of losing our time on the air because of it. The police came in the next day and tried to get all the scripts and they were pretty rough about it. But my script was up in my apartment, and copies could be made from that, of course, and have been. So, it was touch and go for a few days, whether we were heroes or villains. Mm-hmm. And then Dorothy Thompson was a very popular columnist, important columnist, came out and said that we had done the country a favor because we had shown that in a real situation how people could panic and get some ideas of how it can be controlled. And that seemed to turn the whole thing around.
Mayor Dechter has a special presentation to give Howard Koch, which will be our last event this morning. Mayor Dechter?
Now, I would like to officially welcome Howard Koch to West Windsor Township by presenting to him this key to the township that 49 years ago his script put on the map, the national and the worldwide map. I want to present this key to the Howard Koch and hope that he nevertheless will remember this place and this time as a peaceful place and some place that he can remember for some time to come. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Some of you may be wondering why the first Martian machine landed in Grover's Mill.
We take you now to Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Carl Phillips again, out at the Wilmot Farm, Grover's Mill, New Jersey. Professor Pearson and myself made the 11 miles from Princeton in 10 minutes. Well, I hardly know where to begin, so paint for you a word picture of the strange scene before my eyes, like nothing out of a modern Arabian night. Well,
it occurred to me that this was going to be in the form of a battle between two forces, our forces and the Martians, and that I'd better get a map so I could lay out the campaign. And I was passing through the New Jersey part of the 9W, that was then before the thruway. And I stopped at a gas station and I got a map. It was a Jersey map. And when I got to the apartment, I spread the map out because I thought, well, the first thing that I have to decide is where does the first machine come down? So I picked up my pencil, closed my eyes, and put it down on the map. I looked, it was Grover's Mills, New Jersey. And that's how Grover's Mills became the focus of this attention which is going on now.
Why do you think that that there's still such an interest in the thing? Why it's so popular?
Well, I suppose it's like one of those things that people hear about and it's passed down until it gathers its own kind of momentum. Why people are, I suppose, too, that people, in a way, like to scare themselves.
As far as the popularity that it has today, even though it seems antiquated, people are still interested in it. Why do you
think that? Well, it's history. I mean, it is one of the great, historically, it's one of the great events of the new age of mass communications.
The War of the Worlds broadcast still remains a landmark in broadcast history. The associate producer for this program was Thomas Babkowski. Remixing was by Glenn Breda. Special thanks to John Hausman, Howard Koch, Arthur Anderson, and the people of Grover's Mill, New Jersey, for their cooperation with this broadcast.